Brad, what do you think the most popular open source project is?
That's a big question. I bet there's a direct correlation between how simple a project is and how widely used it is.
Yeah, because like my initial thought was maybe it's something like Chromium or something like that, where there's a bazillion user installs, but probably it's not something that a person ever really interacts with, right?
Right. And, you know, it's probably foundational. It's probably like small and extremely good at what it does.
Lib-HTTPS.
Hang on, is this it? Is this the XKCD episode? Are we finally doing the episode about the open source block at the very bottom of the Jenga tower?
Dependency?
Maybe.
I don't know if we've talked about this actually on the podcast before, but when we started talking about this podcast and we were talking with our friends at Google and like we were figuring out what it was, we kept referencing this XKCD, and we'll link it in the show notes, called Dependency, which is literally, it shows the dependency stack for every open source project ever, basically, where it's like a bunch of huge projects that have a bunch of people on them, and then way down at the bottom, there's one thing propping up one side of it that if that one stops working, will break the entire thing. And I think the example in the comic is Image Magic, which anybody who tried to install like blogging software in the early 2000s remembers with varying levels of frustration or fondness, because it was the one that never worked when you were installing movable type back in the day. So yeah, this is it. This is the one. This is that episode, Brad. We're here.
I think with the author of this program estimating that the installations are in the billions, it's pretty safe to say that if this went away, a lot of things would break.
The prophecy has been fulfilled. Welcome to the FossPod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
As always, the FossPod is brought to you by Google Open Source. They bring all of the value of open source to Google and all of the resources of Google to open source. You can find out more about Google's open source at opensource.google. Brad, I am incredibly excited about our guest this week. We have on the FossPod Daniel Stenberg, who is the maintainer of Curl, which is an open source project that is installed on, he estimates, 10 billion machines around the world and maybe off it a little bit.
Yeah, I too was very excited to do this interview. Also kind of weirdly honored because like I don't think I have met anybody whose work has interacted with more human beings than Daniel. Also, we have a lot of coders on the TechPod Discord. And when we mentioned he was coming on, people were like, oh, my God, he's an open source hero. Like, holy crap.
Yeah, I casually dropped at work that we had the curl maintainer coming on the podcast and everybody was like, wait, what? Really?
Right. Everybody and everything uses curl in some way in the development world and internet communications. It's incredibly simple when you break it down in like one sentence, right? Curl is just a small, simple, efficient tool for sending and receiving data. That's it.
Yeah, it works on a bazillion different OSs. You can compile it almost anywhere you want. And it ships with like Windows and OS X and right. Is available on, I think, all Linux platforms I've ever used. In addition to like your OSs and the desktop computers that you use on the day to day, it's also built into all those embedded systems you use.
Yeah. When I did this interview and I was talking to my parents about it and I was trying to communicate to them the import of curl, the thing I told them was every single device in your house has got curl on it. Like the Apple TV, your phones, your car, like anything in your house that's got any kind of connectivity in it has got this program on it.
We talk about this a lot with Daniel, but we talk about protocols a lot because they're foundational to the internet. Curl comes from a time before you had, you know, Dropbox transferring files for you when you were using FTP or HTTP, which are like two of the foundational protocols for the internet. The idea is that these protocols, if you don't know what they are, HTTP is the one that you use to transfer web pages. Everybody uses it every day. FTP is an older file transfer protocol that you used in the before times to get unencrypted files from servers around the world.
Right.
And curl supports a bunch of these, like new and some really ancient stuff too, like Gopher and, yes, and things like that nobody really uses anymore.
Like, you know, it supports stuff like IMAP, which is for email, and SMB, which is for network file sharing, and just, you know, like on and on and on. If you look at the list of protocols that it supports, it's like, protocols are basically like kind of the languages of data transfer on the internet, and it supports most of the ones that are there, I think.
Yeah, if you can move a file from one place to the other. And for people who don't understand, we're not talking about you sending a picture of your kid's birthday party to your mother-in-law. We're literally talking about the head unit in your car downloading a map from the internet of where you are or your phone updating its firmware from an internet server someplace. The kind of stuff that happens a bazillion times a day in the background that you never think about or are aware of. So that's as good a place as any to jump into our conversation with Daniel. For somebody who casts such a long technology shadow, he's a very humble, pretty chill guy. So here we go. I really enjoyed this conversation. Let's get started.
So if we could go all the way back to the beginning of the project, I mean, you started working on curl in 1996, which in a modern open source context is very early. And it seems like a lot of projects in this space start when somebody has a problem that they want to solve, and they set about solving the problem, and that grows. Did you have a problem early on? Was there a spark of some annoyance or obstacle you needed to circumvent that led to the creation of the project?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to find a little tool to download actually just text data or a resource over HTTP. So this was also, you know, very early days search engine wise on the web. So I searched for it. I didn't find any suitable tool to do it for me. Well, actually, I found one, and that's the one I started with. It's what's called HTTP GET. That's the one I found in late 1996. And I started to work with the author, and I soon became maintainer of that, and it sort of took off from there. And I just wanted to download currency rates for my IRC bot. So I started with that little thing. It was about 300 lines of code. It was cool. It downloaded the data I wanted. Sure. And then, you know, maybe it doesn't really work the way I want it to. I'd need to just tweak it a little bit and then, you know, add that and post it online. And someone added some new features. And then one day I realized I wanted to download currency rates, right? So one day I realized, wait a minute, this Gopher site over here, they have a lot of more currency rates. I just need to add Gopher support. And then, so it was called HTTP GET. So I added Gopher support, but nah, it's not HTTP anymore. Let's call it URL GET instead. So I worked on that, and then I found another thing that hosted currency rates on FTP. So I added FTP support too, but it went fine with URL GET. And then someone suggested that I would add support for upload as well, FTP uploads, because, you know, FTP is usually, well, it often in both directions. So I added that too. And then sort of URL GET turned like, there was also a stupid name for a tool that didn't only do GETs, but it could do PUTs or uploads as well. So I had to rename it again. And then I renamed it to curl, removed the GET and PUTs from the name, put in a URL in the name. And there. That was March 1998.
Wow. And then, you know, 23, 24 years later, you're running code on Mars and support an infinite number of potential protocols, it seems like. Like, it is, the documentation for curl at this point is kind of incredible when you look at, I thought I understood what curl did, and I started digging into what you can do with libcurl and all that, and it's an incredibly broad tool at this point for users.
Yes, it has certainly developed into some sort of Swiss Army knife internet protocol transfer thing. So yeah, we count 26 different protocols, and I added, I think, the 248th command line option to curl the other day, or 249, I don't remember, I have the count somewhere, but yes, it's a ridiculous amount.
Yeah, I've got the full list of protocols right in front of me. I mean, it's kind of dizzying, you know, in addition to the ones you mentioned, you know, IMAP, LDAP, RTMP, Telnet, TFTP, you know, SMB, like, did you have a good working knowledge of a lot of these protocols before the project, or was it just like every time you wanted to add one, you had to go dig up an RFC and other documentation and just get up to speed on each one as you went?
Exactly, that later case. So when I started curl, I didn't have an idea about any of these protocols. I didn't even understand the concept of RFCs, right? I just sort of, I think, I don't even remember how I got into HTTP in the first place. But sooner or later, I figured out, oh, there are RFCs specifying them. And then I started to understand how to read them and so on. So, and then every protocol since then, I have sort of learned and had to dig into the specs and see what to do and figure out how you use them and how you want them to be used in a tool like curl and libcurl. So yes, and I'm certainly not as much of an expert in all these protocols as I want to be, but I know a fair bit of most of them. I haven't actually done all the implementations myself. So some of the protocols I'm more of a tourist in and more of an expert in some of the others. So yeah.
I have to imagine there's not a ton of call for Gopher updates at this point. Do you ever think about deprecating old protocols, or at this point is there the maintenance overhead versus the utility of still having them, like a balance you have to think about?
The good thing about those rare protocols like, you know, RTSP or Gopher or some of the others, it is that they're, since they're used so rarely, people don't actually submit many bugs. We don't do much with them. We basically just leave them alone. They sit there in their corner. So they're actually rarely a problem for us. They're just, you know, we don't look at it. We don't care about it. It's just, you know, moving along. So it's actually rarely a problem. So I don't have to bother about removing Gopher. We can just keep Gopher as it is. As long as nobody reports anything and everyone is happy with it, we can just leave it. And every year I ask, and we have this survey, and I ask users, how many are you, what protocols are you using? And out of all the 26, people are always selecting all of them. So at least there are, well, they claim they actually use the product. I don't know. I mean, they say they do it. So I think the least used is 1.7% or something. Gopher this year, I had over 4% of users. So anyway, I just leave it at that. So the reality is that the most used protocols are the ones that get most development, most issues, most problems, and most challenges. So it actually goes sort of hand in hand, really.
Maybe there's a lot of intranet Gopher servers out there that we just don't know about, and people are secretly using them to run their businesses or whatever.
Or the three remaining ones are all just curl users. So, yeah, I don't know.
In your mind, like, what is just a really basic use case for curl at the command line? Like, what do you think the average person, developer or otherwise, like, what is the thing that people are using it for the most these days?
Yeah, you narrowed it down pretty much by saying command line, right? Because in my world, curl is two different universes. It's the curl command line tool and libcurl, the library. And libcurl, the library, is actually where the large volume of usage is and where I spend a lot of time. But command line-wise, which is, command line, the tool is what is more sort of, I guess, more people know about it and use it and stuff like that. So the more typical ones are these basic, simple ones, right? Download an HTTP resource, an image or a file, something, or upload it. Starting there to more complicated things like scripting, you do an automated login on a form, perhaps, or saving cookies, do some more search automatically or update something automatically. And those are, I would say, the rudimentary basic things. And I think that is what people think about curl for, even though, you know, curl has been able to do that for 20 years. So if you only want to do that, you're using the functionality we had a long time ago.
Sure. So a couple of the fun edge cases I like, there's a developer named Igor Chubin who has set up, he has a domain cheat.sh, so you can curl cheat.sh/whatever, like tar, ls, you know, Vim, you name it, and it'll spit out like a kind of friendlier man page than an actual man page. He's also got wttr.in, which gives you a weather forecast. You can curl that. Are there any like wilder, more novel use cases that have really caught your attention that people are using it for?
I've talked a lot about with Igor, and I know he's a very, he's a fan of doing those terminal things, curl outputs with terminals. So I know he's asked, and he's very eager to find others. But I think his case, and you know, he has those currency graphs and stock ticker, all sorts of graphs and stuff in terminals. So I think he's on has the most extreme cases where you can. And I remember he did some Tetris thing with curl too, so that you can, you know, repeated requests to update the terminal with some Tetris magic. I don't remember exactly how he did it. It was really cool.
But I mean, on the libcurl side, though, you're looking at literally billions of installations probably at this point.
Yeah.
Around the world and also not on the world.
Right, exactly. So, in other worlds too, right?
Yeah, I don't think we've talked to anybody who has software that's running on Mars yet. I mean, until today, probably. But yeah, one of the things that I thought was interesting reading about your work is that GitHub, I guess, listed curl as one of the repos that was used on the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars with the Perseverance mission.
Exactly. And the follow-up question that everyone then asks me is, does it actually run in the helicopter? But NASA won't say exactly where it is used. It's just used in the mission project somewhere. So I can't actually, because it doesn't really make sense to use HTTP and TCP from Mars to Earth because of the distance, I think. So it would be, I don't know. But it's still really, really cool. An accomplishment, really.
Yeah, like rover to helicopter maybe makes sense, whereas there's different protocols for interplanetary stuff because of the time delays involved, right?
Exactly.
Back in the 90s, you know, like we said, that was pretty early days for open source development. And it's a good, you know, 96, 98 is kind of a good decade before modern platforms, social media, GitHub, you know, the tools that we associate with open source collaboration today. What was it like in those early days attracting contributors or people to work with, finding information? Like, what was it like making a project this foundational that early on?
Well, it was a very small project that early on, too. So I've saved a screenshot from November 1998 when I wrote about it on the Curl website and said, yoo-hoo, we now had 300 downloads of the latest release. So it was really a slow start, and Curl was really, it has been this gradual growth for a very long time. So we've been at it for, 24 years, but it was certainly not an instant hit. But to go back to the question. So we started out with CVS as a version control, and we started self-hosting. You know, they had this CVSP server, so you could actually download the code over CVS, over the net. So we had that pretty early on. But back in those days, we, of course, were mostly sending patches on mailing lists because that's how everyone did it. And really, that was the way to do it right until we got the distributed version control systems, really. But the big step forward, I think, was when SourceForge launched in late 99. And that was a good first, you know, one of these source code forges, hosts the code, have a bug tracker, have a, you know, mailing list and stuff like that. So it was actually pretty, and that was, they launched in 99, and we put up the Curl source code in December 99, almost immediately. And that was a really good way to attract users and make it accessible to users and developers and so on. So that's how we did it. And it worked really well. And we stuck with CVS and SourceForge for a while. We ditched SourceForge after, I don't know, I think, 10 years, I think. 2010, we switched to GitHub and Git.
I mean, it feels like a lot of projects did that around that same time. It seemed like the right time to make the jump in terms of infrastructure on GitHub.
Yeah, and I think we were a bit slow there, but because we had everything, so it was just, Curl is still a small project. We don't have a lot of code. We don't have a lot of developers, so we don't have a lot of, you know, branches and complications. We just usually have a main branch, straightforward, clean history. So it was easy to just stick to CVS. But one of those days, we just switched to Git because that's where everyone is going. And Git is a much friendlier and better tool in many ways. And, you know, that separating between committers and authors, for example, is a really good way, much better offline and distribution. And then we switched to working the GitHub way of, you know, pull requests and stuff. Also, that took us a few more years, actually, until we did that. But that was also a way to reduce friction, lower the bar, make it even easier for everyone to contribute. Because nowadays, or starting, of course, a few years back, most developers actually have a GitHub account now, and they know how to do, you know, make a fork, make a pull request. So it's easy for people to do that. So it's good for us to do it that way, because it's easy for people to just, you know, find a spelling error or some tiny little thing and you want to fix it. Easy to do that, and we can accept it easily.
So how are decisions made on, you know, just direction, new features and so forth? Because Curl is so ubiquitous, I mean, because it's used by so many important pieces of the internet, are you very cautious about setting a roadmap, adding new features and that sort of thing? What was the decision-making process, the arbitration there?
It is really hard, as you say. And we also make a really big effort to not break existing behavior. So once we launch something, we stick to it as far as we just possibly can. So, of course, we introducing something today, we might want to support it for another 20 years. So we shouldn't just do it lightheartedly, just add stuff we don't really seriously think we should do. But at the same time, it's also very hard to foresee, right? What's the future really going to be about? And so it's really hard. And we have those discussions, what to do and what not to do. People bring in their suggestions. And so it's really, we don't have any magic way to do it. We just have discussions on the mailing list, and I usually have the final say. But yeah, it is exactly as hard as you can imagine. You know, someone brings a feature and says, hey, we think curl should do this in the future. Is this really what curl is about? Is this where the internet is going, or is it, you know, contrary to where the internet is and what we think we should do in the future? So there's nothing else than just, you know, deliberating, discussing, thinking back and forth, and just try to get more input from people. You know, if a lot of people think it's a good idea, maybe it is a good idea. If, you know, if it's just crickets and there's just one person pushing that change and nobody else even wants to talk about it, maybe we can just, you know, hold it for a while, think about it, and see where it goes.
Do you find that there's a core group of like contributors that are the people who are putting the most code in that are the most vocal in that area? Or is it just kind of users or a kind of amalgam of the different groups of people that are involved?
Well, I think like this. So I have a core group of people maybe that I listen to and respect more than others because they've been around for, you know, years. So I know that they're at least not, you know, here and just gone tomorrow. And they understand curl, the project, the architecture, some of the thinking around it. So they are, of course, people that I listen to more. When they say, no, that's stupid because blah, 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 or that's great, we should do it, I listen to those more than, because usually when someone brings in a new feature, those are actually often a newcomer. Someone just, you know, I've never seen that person before. He just submitted it today. Wham, many hundred lines of code. This, we need this. Do we? And who exactly needs it and for what? And in many cases, you know, they're driven by some company where that person works and they want that feature in their product somewhere. And usually, is that a good feature for everyone or do they just want to offload their particular niche on us, right? Niche use case. And we want to have to maintain that forever. They don't have to maintain it because we do it now. So yeah, it's difficult.
I was going to ask, that brings up an interesting question. You know, do you have a good feeling in your head or codified as part of the project about where curl ends and where stuff that's built on top of curl starts?
That's of course. In general, I try to do it like this. It doesn't always work. But curl is about uploads and downloads. So as long as you can, you know, if it's uploading and downloading and it's an application level protocol built on top of IP, then it's curl stuff. But it's also, curl should also not be about the actual content. So if it's, you know, care about the content that is transferred over those application protocols, then it's not curl things either. So if you're within that sort of limited area, then at least, then there's a discussion. Is this curl or not curl? For example, I'm actually working on a particular thing right now, which is WebSockets. And WebSockets is one of those things that doesn't really fit what I actually told you about. But it's still one of those things that is near enough and been asked about so much. So we are going to work on it anyway, even though it's not a perfect match. It's not that perfect upload download.
We've got some questions from our community that I was holding off on until later, but one of them was literally, when are they going to add WebSocket support? Because I need it. So someone on our Discord will be very happy to hear that you said
PR
that.
PR8995.
Great.
So I have to imagine there's like some real hairy edge cases with like authentication, because there's some authentication that's built into protocols and then some authentication that lives on application layer on top of like web servers and stuff like that. And you have to decide, okay, are we going to support the HTTP authentication, but not like Bob log into website C or something like that. And it gets into a place where you have challenging questions to answer, right?
Yeah, but so far we have, when it comes to like authentication, we support a lot of different authentications and we're probably going to support more going forward. That also brings up the question that people tend to ask in that same ballpark is, when do we do loadable plugins or how load a plugin for particular things, particular protocols, particular authentications and stuff like that. So that's also kind of a frequent question. I've never done it and never really considered it because that's open another, you know, that's a Pandora's box of things to go wrong, especially in a curl world when we run on, I have a list with 86 operating systems that curl has been built on. And so, you know, just start to think about doing that in a portable way in all those systems, I rather stick to what works and I go conservative there. But that doesn't really answer the question where I draw the line when it comes to authentications. I think it's more of what people brings, what they argue for, what seems to make sense, and where. And also, you know, I want to do things that I want to support open protocols that are well specified, and that also goes for things like protocols I want to support. I want to make sure that they have a URL specification that is open and somewhat established, or if not an RFC already, and things like that. Because I get a lot of questions about protocols. You know, someone invented it yesterday, and now they want to do support in curl. But wait a minute. For example, curl works with URLs. URLs are designed to be an interoperable unit, right? You should be able to bring that URL to another tool, and the URL should then ideally work, well, maybe not the same, but the URL should be the same. And as if you don't even have a URL format, then it's sort of, you go in a really thin ice, right? So should we really support that then? So in those cases, I try to rather say that, well, come back when you have a URL format that is at least established or used by more than two other tools, and then we can talk about it. So it's also a little bit about that. Unless, of course, it's one of those protocols we just know everyone is going to use tomorrow. Sometimes I have that feeling too, right? Or for example, when everyone started to talk about HTTP/3, I didn't have to get a lot of people tell me that this is going to be the future, because I could just know we are going that way. So I don't have to wait for anyone to argue for that. We will go there, and you can just, in many cases, we can also just, you know, watch the browsers. Anything the browsers implement, we know are likely to be big, so maybe that's a good sign too. If they do it, we can do it too.
So you're actually part of the HTTP working group with the IETF, and I believe version 3 was just adopted recently. How happy are you with where that ended up, and can you give us a sense of what that's going to bring to the... Is that going to be visible to the average user, or are people going to like be able to tell, oh, things are better on the web now, or is that much more about back-end infrastructural improvements?
Well, H3 then is a more of an advancement from H2 that was an improvement on H1. So it has really become, and H3 is even more complicated than H2, and H2 is much more complicated than H1. So that's certainly the trend over the last few 5-7 years, that we are going more and more complicated in the name of reducing round trip time latency and making sure that we can do more things in parallel. But yes, HTTP/3 was made into an RFC finally just last week. Made public at least. So it has actually been a work in progress for a long time, and it hasn't been modified for a long time. So everyone who has been working with HTTP/3 has already, you know, been working with this way of doing HTTP/3 for a while. And we can do HTTP/3 with curl too. It's still an experimental feature in curl, which means that nobody is actually shipping it anywhere enabled by default because of reasons, because it's a complicated protocol. So the protocol itself uses TLS 1.3 details, encryption, authentication, blah, blah, but in a new way that we never did before over TCP. Which means that all TLS libraries that want to support QUIC has to provide new APIs. And that is a slow progress. So there are a few libraries, TLS libraries, that provide these QUIC APIs, but not, for example, OpenSSL doesn't. And since OpenSSL is such a big cornerstone for TLS libraries, and for especially for curl in distros and everywhere, so it's been a friction there. So we haven't been able to develop it that fast. And also the QUIC and HTTP/3 libraries that we are using, they're all also in alpha or beta versions. But other than that, HTTP/3 is really big already. All the big players server-wise are running it. You know, Google, Facebook, Instagram, all the CDNs, Cloudflare, Fastly, all the big ones, they're running it. if you use Firefox or use Chrome today, it's enabled by default and you're already using it. So somewhere around, you know, 25-30% of all web traffic from browsers is already on HTTP/3 right now. And for most people, you won't notice. And especially, you know, us at least, we in the sort of modern luxury world with fast networks, low latency, then it's not such a big deal. But if you're in worse connectivity situations, like more network loss, higher latencies, then HTTP/3 is really starting to pay off. So we've seen a lot of numbers from players showing, you know, the higher percentile you go in crappier connections, the better H3 is going to get. And so for some users, it's going to be a huge improvement. For many, barely visible.
Do you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning kind of worrying about the breadth of this project, the scope at which it's used ever, or is it not something you think about?
Actually, I think I'm probably naively thinking that I'm pretty good usually. So I think I'm in a good situation, and then one day someone submits a security report, and Jesus, did we actually do it? That's so stupid. How could we have done it? Oh, 12 years old bug. Yeah, right. And we've done it this. So I think maybe that's more of my lack of imagination that I think we're good. So I'm you know, naively Justin.
But it would be the security stuff that leaves you up and anxious, I'm betting.
Yes. I would say those are the ones that actually make me tear my hair sometimes. But at the same time, I'm actually usually pretty good at, you know, leaning back on this, that it's everything is open. I haven't tried to hide this. So it's not, it's, you know, even if I wrote most of it, I would say in many cases sort of use it at your own risk and everything like that. So a little bit like that, at least. So once I've proven it, you know, we have a lot of test cases. It's been there for a long time. I feel relatively safe. So I don't wake up being worried.
I mean, if NASA vetted you to run in on Mars, then you're probably okay, is I think a safe litmus test.
Yeah, hopefully. I actually sometimes, you know, when I talk about security and stuff, I say that 10 billion installation, that's not actually guaranteed that it's a good thing, because apparently we had a lot of horrible security problems. You know, people reported them just the other day. So apparently 10 billion installations were installed without people finding these particular ones. So, but that's, you know, that's just software development. So it's, I do get some, you know, I have this constant stream of fun emails from people who are actually finding my email address in their various different devices and send me questions about their devices and that's a fun chapter. I have a special inbox nowadays that I save all them.
I think everybody who has public facing email addresses gets those sometimes. I know that Brad used to get people complaining about video games when he worked at a video game website that had a list of all the video games on it. I used to get it for video cards when I reviewed video cards for a living. Yeah, it's always good.
Yeah, so I get that for all those products, actually. I get a lot of video games. I get a lot of car questions. I get a lot of, I don't know, questions. But sometimes, you know, I don't even understand what they're talking about. And I think usually when they find my email address, they have, you know, they tried everything. They're probably just, you know, tearing their hair off. And, you know, then finally they find my email address. I better mail this guy. And I don't even know what they're talking about. So usually it's the distance between me and that person, that's usually very, very far.
It's one of my favorite things in modern video game development is that a lot of games now let you view the open source licenses right from the title screen, and it's actually heartwarming to me to know that some gamers are actually reading those licenses.
Yes. I remember when I found my name and license actually in Grand Theft Auto 5, the ending sequence. And someone actually pointed it out to me, because it's 44 minutes into the ending sequence. You know, I'm probably the second person who ever saw it. But it was fun. I could show my kids, you know, look, Dad makes games now. So, no.
One of the things we found talking to folks who have projects that have been going for a long time is that there's often an inflection point where they go from like this obscure thing that a handful of people know about and use and find to be a valuable tool. But then there's a moment where you wake up and kind of you're like, this is everywhere. This is way more people are using this than I ever possibly imagined. Do you remember a moment like that for Curl?
No, I actually don't. Well, I think at some point during the 2010 something, I started to do this math and try to, how many users do we actually have? And I remember I wrote a blog post once when I, and I did one count and I said 300 million users. And then I did just while working on it, I did another Google search and realized, oh, wait a minute, I forgot a few hundred million. So I updated the title to 550 million users. So I remember that sort of, I think that was maybe 2010, 2012, something. So then I at least realized that there's a huge amount of curl usage out there. But from my perspective, it never really, it still actually isn't very visible because within the project, you know, it's the same people and the same style of, you know, people asking about problems, whining when things are don't go the way you want it. Why doesn't it support this? Why does it do this? You know, the same thing as they did 20 years ago. It's still the same. I mean, I don't mean to say that they're actually whining, but that's more, but you know, people are reporting bugs. They don't say, hey, you know, we installed curl in a billion mobile phones yesterday. It runs fine. Everyone is happy. I don't get to hear about that because they took curl, they run off and they're happy. The other three users who actually find problems, they are the one who actually come to me and say, hey, when I do this, this bad thing happens. So it's hard sometimes.
You don't hear from the end users who are driving the car that the firmware updated automatically over the air when it works right, I guess.
Right. And neither, I don't even get to hear from the developer who successfully used curl right when they installed that in the firmware too, because they just managed to do it correctly and everyone was happy.
I think one of the things we're most interested in on this show is the kind of human aspect of working on open source projects, which frequently don't generate revenue versus having to earn a living, right? So you've had a long career in software development, but I think it's right that you only recently have come to work full-time on curl in your day job. Is that correct?
Yes. So I worked on curl as a spare time project and for a very long time. And then I joined Mozilla in 2014. And then they actually allowed me to spend some amount of my work hours on curl, just out of their goodness, of their hearts, really, because Mozilla and Firefox, they don't use curl. Well, they actually have some little thing that uses it, but I didn't do it for them at least. So I got to spend up to 20% of my work time on curl. And that was a good thing to do. Of course, I appreciated it and that was fun. And then in 2019, when I had quit Mozilla, I decided I would try to make it a full-time job. So then since then I do it full-time. I work with a company called WolfSSL and we sell support to customers. So I, you know, support contract development, feature development, whatever anyone actually wants when it's related to curl.
It has to be difficult balancing this project that billions of installations use on a daily basis and like, hey, I'm spending all this time on this in my free time, I air quoted that. You know, did you have moments where you just kind of like, I don't think I want to do this anymore? Or has it just been something that you find fulfilling and really good all the way through? Or
I have never felt that I should, that I would give up. So because I've never been that down in a black hole. But of course, you know, inspiration and what feels fun and not, that goes a little bit up and down. Sometimes it doesn't really feel that funny or interesting. So sometimes the motivation maybe isn't on top, maximized on particular things. But I've come to learn that it just goes up and down a little bit like waves. Sometimes it's not as fun. Sometimes it's super fun. And it really depends on me and what I get to do, a little bit of users influx and what people say and so on. So it just comes and goes. And since I've done this for such a long time now, I just have learned that it comes and goes a little bit. So if I sort of feel a lack of motivation sometimes, I just, you know, I can just scale it down a little bit. Maybe I don't spend as much time on it. I can just do something else. Spend more time with my family, maybe find some other project to work on, maybe watch TV more, or, you know, it comes back. I know that it comes back. It always does. So I don't have to stress out about it. And sometimes it's so, on the contrary, then it's super fun that I can't really stop working on my stuff, even, you know, when it's 1 a.m. in the morning, I really should go to bed because it's a day tomorrow too. So I still have that.
It sounds like you enjoy kind of picking apart the protocols and figuring out how they work. Is one of the feelings I got from reading some of your older blog posts, especially.
You know, it certainly is that. I've always appreciated or thought about network-oriented development and programming with network protocol stuff is fun. And that has continued to be the case. I still think that is fun. I still appreciate working with protocols. And that's also why I think it's fun to work with the IETF and the HTTP group there and Quick and everything, because I think it's fun to be there, submit my feedback, and make sure that things improve so that we as a community make things better and improve over time. And, you know, and so, yeah, I really, for me, working with curl and protocols and networking full time all the time, it's a bit of a dream come true. So, I still spend a lot of spare time on curl, but now we can spend work time and spare time, and I don't even have to bother about separating them because it doesn't matter to anyone.
There's something magical about the idea that you can take a protocol for sending data from a server to a client and for what to do with that data on the client side, and then all of a sudden 20 years later, 25 years later, this, you know, there are trillions of web pages and, you know, the entirety of human knowledge from the last 20 years is available to anyone to go find if they want. There's a lot of talk about metaverse stuff right now. I hesitate to even bring it up because it's kind of loaded and weird. But do you feel like companies that are trying to own this, hey, next evolution of the web and internet are kind of missing the point of open protocols? Or are we getting ahead of ourselves? Do you not care at all? I'm kind of curious where you land.
I think that even that kind of development, and even when people are talking next level things, they are still building on these protocols. So even if you go crazy and talk Web3 or whatever, they are still going to talk about do that over HTTP. And, you know, even Facebook, when they make their client, actually, you know, their mobile phone client is actually also talking HTTP3. So even though when you have a proprietary client, proprietary server, they are still using these protocols. So I think going forward, I think we are going to see a lot of more crazy things built on top of this. But I think these protocols are here to stay, and we are going to see them being used and developed further much more still. So I don't see us going away from these protocols. I think we're going to use them even more going forward.
Prior to Mozilla, when curl was purely a spare time project for you, were you ever known on the various teams you worked on as the curl guy? Like, did that ever give you some prestige around the office or on the teams you worked on that you also did this very important thing on the side?
Surprisingly rarely, actually. So I did a lot of consultant work and a lot of embedded Linux and stuff like that before. And it was very rare that even anyone actually mentioned curl or curl-related things. So no, I was mostly under the radar when it came to those. Actually, when I did all my interviews at Mozilla, that was sort of a little bit of an eye-opener, because when I joined Mozilla, I found myself in a world where everyone knew curl, everyone knew that I had written it, and you know, of course, you know HTTP, so we don't have to talk about that. Now we can talk about something others. So yeah, I think up until that point, my spare time projects and my professional projects, they were sort of two different worlds. And from 2014, they more or less united and collided.
So you've written that a fair number of the vulnerabilities in curl are due to C mistakes, and you're also starting to support backend components written in Rust. How do you feel about the kind of modern memory-safe languages like Rust and some of the others? Do you have strong feelings about those, and is that a direction you could see the entirety of curl migrating in at some point, or is there too much of a legacy C code base for that to be feasible?
First, I think Rust is a cool effort and a good language, I think, for doing things like replacing project, or rather modules or components in projects like piecemeal one by one and go into a memory safe world. And that is roughly what we're doing with curl, right? We're trying to, when you build curl, you actually build curl to work with a particular set of backends, like we call them, more, you know, modular components, and you decide them when you build curl. And more of those are now provided written in Rust, so you can select more and more third-party dependencies that are written in Rust and then supposedly more memory safe. And one of those things we've done over the last 1.5 years maybe is that we're supporting now a way to replace a good chunk of the HTTP implementation in curl with one written in Rust called Hyper. So that is certainly one way to go more out of the executable component. More of that becomes curl or memory safe code. But at the same time, I'm very aware and I'm going to keep the C written parts as well as an alternative for those who want it, because I think in my world curl is this big and versatile and everywhere thanks to it being portable and provided and running everywhere, and it runs on so many more platforms than Rust is even trying or caring about. So I think covering both worlds, that's where I'm going forward. So I'm going to maintain the C coded versions, and I'm going to allow and push for the Rust coded versions as well. And for me, that's also a little bit of a Darwinism too, because if it turns out that one of them goes much better than the other, then I could put more focus on that one. Let's say everyone want to use the Rust coded dependency going forward, then sure, we spend all the effort on that part and maybe less on the C coded part, or vice versa. So I don't have to, that's a good way for me to, you know, test the waters and see what do people actually want. Do people actually want to go that way, or do they don't? So I don't know. So I'm keeping all doors and availabilities open, really. I'm not going to rewrite all of curl in Rust anytime.
I have to imagine with the project as broadly used as this, just keeping track of feedback is challenging, right? Are you just watching the mailing list and listening to people who are actively engaged in conversation, or is there a broader attempt to kind of figure out what the larger, broader audience is actually using?
Well, usually I try to do a little bit of everything. So, of course, I read the mailing list. I read what people tell me on Twitter. I listen to what people say wherever. And of course, if people submit a lot of bugs around some particular areas, you know, maybe there's a pattern here. We can see everyone suddenly start to ask about something. Maybe that's something to do to consider. And I mentioned previously about we have an annual survey that we ask users, what do you want to see next? What do you don't want to see? What do you think is good? What is bad? That's also a way to try to get people to tell us what to do and what's good, what's bad. Because, you know, I don't want to go have one loud user say we should do this, because that's not a good way to go. But if, you know, if there's 17 users who say maybe we should look into this independently of each other, maybe that is something to look into. So that's the way I usually go about it. And, you know, if I then ask the question several years in a row and I see a lot of people saying, sure, do that, that's a pretty good sign that maybe we should do it. WebSockets is one of those things. I've asked about WebSockets for, I don't know, I think I've had this survey, I think this is the 8th year in a row, and I think I've asked about WebSockets every single year in the survey, and it's always been voted very high. So I know that there's at least a lot of users who say they would be interested in WebSockets. So I finally started.
You're doing WebSockets.
Yes.
Let's say you wake up tomorrow and decide you just want nothing to do with curl. You're done. Like, it's a hypothetical. Do you have contingencies so that the project carries on, or do you just kind of assume open source will do the open source thing and a bunch of people will fork it and somebody will come out of the weeds, you know, with the new curl?
More of a ladder, I would say. So because we don't have any, there's no steps. I haven't written anything. There's no testament saying this is what to do if I get run over by a bus or if I take a holiday. Someone said to me that it's not the bus factor, it's the holiday factor.
We were trying to give you the less morbid example there, yeah.
So yeah, but if I would go on a holiday tomorrow, there are, you know, there are regulars who are around in a project and they can step up at any point if they want to. So they have permission to do everything pretty much that I can do. And I've always made sure that everything is documented everywhere. And that is one of the reasons why I've always also worked really hard to make sure that curl scores very high on the OpenSSF best practices scoreboard, if you've seen that. So curl is actually one of the few projects there that have reached all the way to the golds level. So I've tried to, you know, check all the check marks, make sure that everything is documented. Everything in the project is actually documented. Every way how we work, every role in the project, how we maintain, how we work, how, you know, how we review code. So the idea being that even if you don't care about it today because you don't have to, if I, you know, get lost tomorrow, you can actually read up on most of the details. Most of everything is already documented. It's there. It's available. So you can pick up where I left it if you need to and if you want to. So that's where I'm going. So I'm hoping that by making sure that everything is documented, done correctly, it should be doable. Then, of course, we don't practice and we haven't written it down. So who knows what happens, but that's the theory I go with.
I was going to say, it's the reading the documentation. My expectation with open source projects is that the software is usually really solid and the documentation's kind of, you know. You all are definitely the exception to the rule with this from what I've seen, and it's exhaustively documented. I'm curious what your time split as the maintainer is between making sure that the documentation is up to snuff and, you know, keeping up with security stuff and adding new features. And, like, you know, how do your days break out usually? Do you have a dedicated, hey, let's spend some time every week on the documentation, or do you just have people that kind of, you know, you can trust to maintain that stuff at this point?
Well, I still do like 55% of all commits on a day to day. So I do a lot of that, but I don't have that. I don't have that sort of arranged. I don't have that scheduling, but of course I'm a maintainer now. I don't do a lot of feature development, period. So that I do WebSockets now, but that's more of a, you know, an exception. I don't actually do a lot of new features. I basically work on bug reports. I work on fixing bugs, and that's what I do. And we call help users who didn't actually suffer from bugs because they just misunderstood. And I think a lot of what I do, or what I try to do, is update the documentation when people are having problems or got into a dead end. Why did you think that? Sort of try to reason with people. Was it something in the documentation that made you think that we could do it that way? Or did it actually say you could do it that way, but it didn't work? Or, you know, if it wasn't documented, where would you even look for this? Because, you know, that's really difficult when the documentation has grown to this size. Where do people actually look for things? Because, you know, it's a little bit of a needle in a haystack, right? We can add a lot of documentation, but it doesn't really matter if people can't find it, and it becomes harder and harder to find things. So I try to do that, and of course add test cases when, you know, people report a bug and we fix it. So that's what I work on the most, I would say. And I don't have a method for that. I just, you know, I start my morning by looking at the GitHub issues. Are there any new serious ones? I always let security problems, you know, that's my highest priority. So if one of those arrive, I work on those, and we have had a lot of those recently. There's going to be more. So I just, and then I try to just round robin around all of those that need me. And of course, back to the motivation part, I also want to have fun. So sometimes I can just, you know, drop that, go and do something that I think I just want to do because it's fun and because maybe I think we should do it. And just leave those issues for a while. They can wait a few hours. I can do something else. I can take a walk, or I can, you know, work on some silly features that maybe aren't that important, but it's fun because I need to keep everything working for me as a person too.
It really warms my heart to hear you. You know, you've written about IRC, and you mentioned it in this interview already. Like, as someone who also, I literally owe my career to spending too much time on IRC in the 90s. Do you miss that era of the internet when everything was just completely open and democratized and standards were just there to be used? I mean, now that we've moved into this more modern era of walled gardens and communication platforms that are controlled by corporate entities, like, do you yearn for those simpler times?
I can sort of miss it for the simpler times and for the optimism and for the belief in, you know, open protocols, that this is the way we would do everything going forward. So sure, I can think back about, like, in a nostalgic way, but at the same time, I'm not really that person. I'm more looking ahead, and this is what we have now, and this is what we work with. I always appreciate open standards, open protocols, and open source. So that is where my heart always belongs. So that is where I tend to work, and I use those solutions and products and services to as much as I can. And I also advocate for projects and us to use that. I don't always live up to it. So we have that discussion repeatedly. Do we use GitHub, or are we on GitLab, for example? But no, we're on GitHub, and that's a proprietary platform. But yeah, so there are trade-offs, of course.
Sometimes you use the tool because the tool is the good tool, not because it's necessarily the aligns as perfectly as you'd like with your ideals.
Yeah, I also have to be pragmatic. Exactly. Okay. So there's a little bit of a give and take. Sometimes go the harder route that is open. Sometimes go with a closed that is more accessible, maybe. And in like in the GitHub case, as I said, that's we've selected to go where the majority of developers are.
That's a great answer that kind of brings me right to my next question, which is, if we were to ask you to look into your crystal ball and try to envision, you know, either at a low technical level or just broadly, what does the internet look like 10 years from now, 20 years from now? Do you have any specific sense of where things are going or what we might have to look forward to?
Looking back and sort of what would I have said to answer this question 10 years ago, I wouldn't have any clue at all where we were going. And usually I don't even try to, you know, tell how the future is going to look like. And I think part of the success of what I've done with Curl is that I have never tried to sort of second guess where we are in 5 years. I need to implement that today, because that's not how protocol stuff works. I can usually, you know, I can go with what's around the corner next 6 months ahead of time. That's usually more of the time frame that I can look at, and then I go and work on that. Because if I would say, if I would look at the further future, that is further away than 6 months, I would say that I think more generically that we will have more networking going forward, because I think we are all going to do even more things, you know, Internet of Things, everything. Pretty much, I think a clear trend just now is that everything that can get networked gets networked. Well, pretty much everything gets a battery sooner or later, and as soon as you have a battery, you can soon have it networked, and as soon as you have it networked, you want it to access the internet in one way or another, even if that's your coffee mug or toothbrush, or, you know, everything is going networked. And when you're going networked, sooner or later Curl comes into the picture, or could come into the picture. So I think that is where we're going. We're going to go in a world with a lot more networking. But exactly how that is going to turn out, then I don't know. Usually, in my case, back to the question where people are going with protocols, is that at least the trend going looking back and where we've gone is that HTTP survives and reaches into all those tiny devices. So even, I mean, back in the day, maybe 20 years ago, we were all talking about different embedded specific protocols. You know, we couldn't do TCP, or we couldn't do HTTP, or we couldn't do HTML, or we couldn't do any of that. But the longer we go, we see that no, we're moving all those sort of real, full-fledged protocols into all those tiny devices. So I think HTTP and all those, even though newer HTTP protocols, are going to be more widely used in more devices going forward.
Cool.
Even if H2 and H3 are very complicated. So for now, I think we're stuck to the more simpler, like HTTP1 in simpler devices.
Like I mentioned, we have a few questions from community members. I think this question is quite cheeky. Someone asked, has there ever been a rivalry with Wget?
Well, I try to, make sure that we have that rivalry, at least joke about Wget, and make sure that, so that we have that friendly banter around with it. But in reality, I think I'm I'm sort of friends or acquainted with all the maintainers of wget over the years, at least, and I've actually provided code to wget as well. So I don't, it's actually more of a friendly sort of, yeah, we can poke at each other sometimes, but usually our paths don't actually cross that often. So they have their project, they do their things, we have our project, we do our things. Every once in a while, of course, people ask me why they would use curl when they could use wget and vice versa. And my answer is always use whatever works. I'm not going to tell you to abandon anything. If wget works for you, use it and stick with it as long as it works for you. And I think that goes with everything. You should use the tool that works for you. I get a lot of, you know, people, when, of course, since I'm Mr. Curl, people then ask me more, you know, guilty looking and said, should I really use this? You know, do I approve or should I, am I angry now? And that also goes with all the appears in, you know, new curl alternatives or competitors or other tools that are in particular HTTP oriented, you know, HTTPy, I think they call it, or related tools that are more try to approach HTTP interaction in new ways. And I always add there too, use whatever works. I don't think if there's anything competition is good for, it is to people to, you know, provide new ways of doing things, show how to do it better. If someone can make a better way to do things, that's good, right? I don't insist or maintain that curl is the best way to do things. It just happened to be a way to do it. I'm actually usually glad to find people trying out new things. Maybe they could, you know, show the way how to do it in a much better way. Then we can copy their way. Maybe a new way to look at interactions or interfaces or command line options or whatever. I usually find it hard because we have to support everything we already shipped 20 years ago. But apart from that, I'm all open for new ways, and competitors and are a great way for users to try out new things and say, curl is silly because it does it that way. You should do it this way instead. Sure.
So another user question here. Debian has a couple of times introduced ABI breakages into libcurl downstream of your work. How do you handle situations like that where I assume, you know, you're probably getting feedback from people who are inconvenienced by these things, but it's not actually, you know, this is happening downstream of the work that you're doing. How does that play out in terms of support and working with distro makers and so forth?
Yeah, you know, that's distros in general are a little bit of our friends and enemies at the same time. Because, yes, sometimes distros make, I mean, we don't ship binaries, right, from the project. We just ship source code. So the ones who actually ship the packages and the binaries, they are, in this case, then distros. So they make their own choices how to do things. And quite often, they disagree with what we think, like what is an API breakage and what isn't. So when we think it's one, like in Debian, they actually went the other way twice. So in the original case, they disagreed with it being API breakage when we thought it was one. And then decade later, they thought the other way around, that we had a breakage that we didn't think we had. So, and that's just one of the things that we have to live with. I've come to peace with that. So usually, the good part is usually that their users have to suffer and they get the feedback and they handle the feedback. And usually if someone brings that feedback back to us, it's quite easy to say that that's not the thing we did, talk to them about it. So that's usually pretty easy to handle, actually. I think what is harder sometimes is that distros have a way of catching other bug reports as well. You know, someone experienced a bug and they file that bug with their distro and it sits in the distro's bug tracker for a long time, maybe. And it's actually bug upstream in our code. I did a mistake, right? But I don't get to know about it because it was just stuck somewhere in some bug issue tracker somewhere. And, you know, there are a lot of those bug trackers everywhere. So I actually sometimes scour through them to see, just to find those kind of, you know, leftovers someone reported 3 years ago, a spelling mistake in an error message, maybe I should fix it. But there are also very good distros that are forwarding all of those upstreams or, and, you know, with patches and everything. So it goes really all in all directions. Sometimes it's really good. Sometimes it's rather bad. So it's, we have everything. And when you have this many distributors and, you know, many, even the commercial operating systems like, you know, Windows and Mac OS ship curl too these days. So they also have the same kind of problems and mistakes that they don't upgrade, and they build up bugs, and people are submitting bug reports to us about bugs that Apple ship to in their operating system, right? That's not my bug, really. Talk to your supplier. So that's a little bit of all of that.
Sure, sure. Cool. Last question for me here. So this question comes from our community, but it's also kind of my question. You do a great thing on your website that I also love to kind of do in my head, which is you have a pretty exhaustive inventory of every computer you've ever owned and worked on, from your, you know, modern development laptops and x86 machines all the way back to your old Amigas and C64. Which one of those platforms was your favorite to work on? When you think back, like, which one of those eras gives you the most kind of warm, fuzzy feelings about your early development?
Oh, the Commodore 64. No questions about that. So that, no, that was a special thing, special hardware, different. Well, it was also in my teens, and I got to, you know, I got into programming. I learned assembly. We wrote demos, and we, you know, friends, and we went to meetings with people from all over Nordic countries here. So yeah, it was a very special time. So I'm very fond time and period in my life. And I actually met a lot of people then that sort of stuck around that I'm still working with today. Yeah. So I have my own company together with three friends that when we all met in those late 1980s era on the Commodore 64. That's really, it really sort of made a foundation, sort of that mark in my life. And that's sort of that, I would say that's one of the things that made me the person I am today.
Did you do any actual demo scene work? Any, you know, like kind of 8K demos, 64K demos, that sort of thing? Any graphics work, or were you adjacent to that scene?
Yeah, well, we did a lot of demos on that Commodore 64. We were called Horizon. So if you go, you can go YouTube some C64 Horizon demos. At least some of our more latest ones are on YouTube. Not so many on mine, but still. Yeah, that was a great time. We spent a lot of time doing weird demo things for no useful purpose.
But that's the least likely historical fact I was expecting to hear in this interview. I mean, you know, that scene led to, you know, like Remedy, that makes a lot of very popular video games like Control, and Alan Wake, I believe, has roots in the demo scene in Finland and so forth. It's just that community.
And when we had a Horizon group on Commodore 64, and we switched to also started with Amiga in maybe 1989. And some of the early guys on Horizon Amiga, they were the ones on Illusion, they made, or Pinball Dreams they made later. So they were some of the early Electronic Arts or whatever they went later. So yeah, a lot of that time and a lot of pioneers in computing and of course started there then. So yeah, it was a special time.
There was a real Scandinavian, like I remember reading about that here in the States in the early 90s and thinking, oh man, that's, people in Scandinavia are doing really cool stuff with computers that I've never even considered before, and downloading these tiny, tiny files and running them on my 386 or whatever. Is there something about the region that just drew people to this, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. Since I was just there, it just happened to me, and I had a lot of friends, so we just found each other, but I had friends then all over, at least Northern Europe, so it was a lot of Germans and Dutch people and everywhere, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, so yeah, we were all over, and I don't know how it happened to be just here. I know that, for example, why it didn't cross over to North America that easily was that we did it everything by scan lines on the TV, and you had NTSC and we had PAL. So you couldn't easily just run the same thing on the different TVs. So that was one of the reasons why it was such a clear divider between Europe and North America, at least. But I don't know. why it happened like that.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Where can people find your work if they want to know more about you?
Well, that's the project at curl.se, and I'm at Bagner on Twitter, and that's where I hang out.
Thank you again to Daniel for taking the time to talk to us. That was a very edifying conversation. But like I said at the top, like, curl is everywhere. Like, if you're on a Windows machine or a Mac, you can just open a command prompt and type it, and it will tell you. I've got it right in front of me. If you just type curl, it'll say try curl --help for more information. And it's just got, like, very friendly, plain language. If you just want to poke around at it, it's, like we keep saying, it's one of the most foundational tools out there if you want to get a little bit better of understanding about how data is sent back and forth. And it's not usually included in most Linux distros, but if you're using Linux, then you have curl already anyway. You've probably taken care of that.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, like, we talked about this a little bit in the start of the interview, but the curl command line tool is actually far and away less used than libcurl, which is the API that anybody can integrate in their application. So, you know, when he talks about curl being in GTA, pretty sure that's libcurl. You know, there's no,
yes,
Trevor Phillips isn't typing curl commands on his fake computer in the game. But yeah, it was great to talk to Daniel, and we love doing the show. So if you have ideas for projects that you think we should focus on and go meet the people, please send them to us at fosspod@content.town. And I guess that'll do it for us this week. So thanks, as always, to our sponsor. The FOSSPOD is brought to you by Google Open Source, where they bring all of the value of open source to Google and all the resources of Google to open source. You can find out more at opensource.google. As always, Matt Purdy produced this episode and Sabrina Hill edited it. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
We will be back in 2 weeks with another episode of the FOSSPOD. See y'all then.